Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Racing Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, live from Milton, Ontario, Canada. This is Chuck Snow, your host tonight, and unfortunately, Rico Muhammad isn't able to join us, but fortunately, our good friend and legal genius, Hank Seaton, is going to co-host this show. I'm going to bring Hank on right now. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to do this show a little bit different. Those of you that have called in for the Trendline report, you're not going to get it tonight because Hank and I are going to discuss some things right off the bat. So we're not going to be doing the Trendline or the USDA rates or the bad broker report. We're going to get right off the bat to discussing legal issues. A lot of people out there want to hear about them, what's going on. If you'd like to join the conversation or ask a question, please just press one and hopefully I can patch you in. I was trying to get my daughter, Carly, to be the switchboard operator tonight, and I messed up, not Carly. So I'm going to try to be your host and your switchboard operator, so bear with me. And I'm going to bring Hank Seaton on. Hang on one sec. Hank, are you with us? Oh, are you there? Hello? Hank, do you hear me? Hang on, we're going to try something else. Hank, do you hear us? Okay, we'll try this again. Hank, do you hear? Oh, you know what? I may have got the wrong. Hang on a second. Hank, is that you?
I'm here.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much. Welcome to the show. It's always an honor to have you on. I guess you are my co-host tonight, and I got to tell you, I couldn't ask for a better co-host.
Well,
how are you this evening?
Thank you much. I look forward to it.
Hank, let's get right to the chafe here. There's a few things that have been coming up that are really bothering me, and I've been waiting for this opportunity to discuss them online on the show with you. And what they are is, number one, I'll tell you what they are. Number one, I do want to talk mostly about bills of lading. I don't think that a lot of our listeners and the carriers out there are paying enough attention to what they're signing. I think they end up at a shipper's door and they're signing anything. They're not reading it. They're not counting freight. They're not pulping temperatures. You know, I hear about all of it. And I want to discuss that. The other thing that's really bothering me lately is, and I just had an incident today where I had heard from somebody through this show a few weeks ago that was in dire need. He lived in Flint, Michigan, and not only does he have bad water to contend with, he's got an issue where he bought a truck from a trucking company on what we like to refer to as the Never Never plan, and paid for the truck. Him and his wife ran their tails off running coast to coast. They paid for the truck. Somehow this trucking company that they bought the truck from ended up, creating bogus bills. And the truck was never, they never had clear title of the truck. The people that sold it to them in the first place, they never had clear title and they resold this truck. So the truck ended up locked up in a compound down in Texas for 6 months. And I gave them the name of a lawyer I know that's operating out of Michigan, a lawyer by the name of Martin Levitt. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a transportation lawyer there. And Martin said when he heard about the case, he was just about in tears. They came in to see him, and he's handling it for them. But I want our readers, our listeners, to know about the dangers of some of these never, never plans. And the third thing, if we get a chance, that I want to discuss, if possible, is I'm seeing more and more right now. We've got ads out for owner-operators, and these guys are coming in wanting work, and they're underwater. and somebody has sold them trucks for with payments between sometimes as much as the highest I've seen is $5,700 a month for a truck payment. You know, and it's just insane. So those are the three things I'd like to talk about tonight, if we can, that I think need to be addressed.
And our 55 minutes left, okay?
Okay, well, we're going to try. It's an awful lot to put forward in 55 minutes.
You want to start with the bill of lading issue?
Yes, can we start there? Because I don't think enough people put enough respect on a bill of lading. I don't think they quite understand what it is. And a bill of lading, as we both know, is a contract between the shipper and the trucker. And if anybody out there would like to call in, just press 1, and you're more than welcome to ask a question to either Henry or myself, or give us your perspective on things.
So let's give you a little background, Chuck.
Okay.
For us old hands, we remember the Uniform Bill of Lading and the days of regulation down here. And
yes,
you're absolutely right that a bill of lading can be a contract of carriage. Most sophisticated shippers have traditionally used the uniform bill, and it or the standard truckload bill are typically incorporated in a contract. A contract can trump a bill of lading. By that I mean that you can put in a contract that, notwithstanding whatever is handed between the parties at the time of pickup, the contract will trump it, and that frequently happens. As part of deregulation down here in the States, they changed the rules so that you don't have to have a bill of lading as a contract. All that the regulations require is that the carrier issue a receipt, and that receipt must show the origin, the destination, the commodity, the weight or whatever is necessary for rating the freight bill. And if the carrier signs it and gives it to the shipper, there's a presumption that the shipment is received in good order. That's what results in, as you well know, on the produce end, you don't get anything that looks like a uniform bill with the standard blocks. So
right.
When you get through with all of this, it's not the clarity that there should be in terms of the standard rules of commerce that should apply by default. I'm a big proponent of the idea that there are basic rules of commerce in terms of what the carrier's expectancy is, what constitutes a claim, salvage. There are 61 issues that are on the standard bill of lading. If anybody wants to go to my website, I've got them all set out there. And most of those rules really benefit the carrier. So, you know, I think you shouldn't be afraid of a standard bill of lading. But all too frequently, there can be things hidden on a bill of lading that a truck driver doesn't take the time to recognize or see. And there really can be I gotchas. One of the things that concerns you and I is the U.S. FSMA law, which says now that the carrier must abide by the shipper's instructions. So, you know, if you get a load of bananas and you know that bananas are supposed to be kept within a certain temperature variance, but the bill of lading says must be set at an exact temperature with reefer on continuous run, you gotta pay attention to that, because now all of a sudden they've entered a new contract issue that the driver has to be sensitive to, and that can become an I gotcha. Or if the bill of lading says must deliver 5 a.m. sharp in Cincinnati, and you ain't got the hours to get there, you may be getting set up for a rejected load or come back in 3 weeks. So all of those kinds of things, when they get put onto a bill of lading, carriers need to kind of take a drivers need to take a little extra time and be sure that what is contained isn't something that they can't live with. Does that kind of explain how the law and the facts get intermingled to cause problems?
It does, and it makes it so unfair. And you're right, but that was one of the things that we always had was the Uniform Bill of Lading, and it was a pretty standard form. Now, you know, you may have Heinz or whatever on the top of the Bill of Lading, but it was still a Uniform Bill of Lading under such and such an act. And now, of course, we have 57 different varieties of shipping orders. As compared to the old standard.
One of my take homes from this is particularly if you are flying your own flag and having to sign contracts, you will very typically see in a contract that the contract is all that there is and nothing else binds the shipper. I try to instruct my clients to put into the contract that the terms and conditions of the standard truckload bill of lading shall apply. And there's
right.
good reason for that. That confines your liability to CARMAC. It takes out special and consequential damages. It requires you just to deliver the shipment with reasonable dispatch. It takes a whole lot of otherwise aberrant terms and conditions that you aren't covered for in terms of insurance out of the game. And if it's in the contract, there should be a provision in the contract that says non-conforming provisions in a bill of lading issued at time of pickup won't change those uniform rules. Let's face it, we got enough problem getting the load on and getting it inspected that it take 30 minutes to look through a bill of lading to see if there are gotchas.
Yeah, and quite often, there can be those I gotchas, and that's why if you're picking up a load, you've got to be so cautious. I always warn our drivers when they start, drivers and owner-operators, that if they're out in places like, especially in California, Arizona, Texas, even Florida, and they're loading produce at these sheds, they've got to pulp the produce. Don't sign for things unless you know what you're signing for, because you're signing for it. As a customer of mine said, and he was in the trucking business and got into the bakery business, as he said once, really, when you sign that bill of lading, you're almost taking title to the product. You own it while you're in care and control of it. So make sure you know what you're signing for.
Yeah, what you've just mentioned is a continuing problem in produce, and It is produce really isn't subject to the CARMAC amendment, but
right.
It's called the inherent vice defense. And what happens increasingly now that the retail groceries are demanding instantaneous delivery, suppliers are loading produce hot out of the field, and it's not properly pre-chilled. So if it looks like it's in apparent good order when you pick it up, no amount of air conditioning on the way to destination is going to keep the damn thing from rotting. So, I think you would think that, produce would be kind of a rough item to haul that wouldn't be subject to specifics. But you really have to watch the shipper load and count. It's not shipper load and count. Watch what you're signing for in the produce area. Lots of times the claim is broken over the carrier very simply because when it gets there, it's not in good condition. But if you look at the temperature gauge, you'll see that he maintained it in good condition all the way, but it takes almost a forensic scientist to then go back and prove that it was inherent vice and the product was loaded hot. But somebody who can read a reefer can really help on that.
Right. And that's one of the things I always tell our drivers. If you're in one of these produce sheds, number one, you've got to remember every produce shed probably has some rotten product on it. And the person that's loading that truck probably gets a little bonus for getting rid of that rotten product on an unsuspecting truck driver. I'm not saying that happens all the time, but I know that it does happen sometimes. That's number one. Number two, when that produce is coming in hot and heavy from the fields in California and Arizona and Texas, and it's 104 degrees out, it's very, very expensive for those cooling sheds to cool it off because electricity is expensive. So if they can pawn some hot produce off on a trucker, off their dock, off their mind. So it's so important for the drivers or owner-operators or carriers to make sure that they pulp every single skid to check the temperature and make sure it's cooled down. And don't be in such a hurry to get out of there with a hot load of produce, because when you get to New York City or Chicago, it's going to get rejected, and you drove all that distance for nothing. So that's why it's so important.
And the real issue, and I can tell you that it's one of the banes of my existence, is that if the load is rejected by the wholesale grocery house, it's the delivering carriers to salvage, and ultimately it's going to be taken out of his hide. The claim is going to be offset without any adjustment, and usually the monetary value is enough to break a small carrier, but not enough to go back and do some reconstruction. I've got a shipment. I won't use any names, but I've been working on it today. Got a sizable client that transports 10 cans. They're new 10 cans, and obviously they're going to be used to load in pop or beer or something like that. They make hundreds of deliveries to a particular bottler, and all of a sudden, maybe 8 weeks after the deliveries of a series of shipments for a particular vendor, they got all of these claims that the bottles had been destroyed because there was water in the cans, and they said, "Well, you know, obviously you signed for them free and clear, and when we inspected them here, there was water damage, and we had to trash them, and you owe us $78,000." Well, the client's insurance company denied it, even though there were 8 or 10 loads, and we did a little forensic examination. And it turned out that out of all of these shipments we had handled, well, we didn't have any other water damage. And these trailers had been offloaded and then turned around and used to haul other cans, and they hadn't leaked. And the days that were involved, there wasn't any rain. Now, you would think we'd have a pretty good defense at that point. Well, to add to it, we had someone go and take a look at the records from the warehouse where they originated, and they'd had storm damage and a hole in their roof.
Wow.
Now, you know, to a smart dude, you would say, all right, look at here. You proved it didn't rain. You proved there was no leak in the trailers. Your consistency shows that the same trailers were used and didn't encounter this problem anywhere else. And these whole clump of claims all originate at the same time from the same warehouse, which had leak in its roof. Well, do you know what kind of issue you've got now to try to get your $78,000 back from the disgruntled consignor? I mean, you know, this is just the truth that trailer is stranger than fiction. And
yeah, that's
obviously the consignor got upset. It's his one of his big customers. The customer apparently didn't do much of a job of inspecting it to isolate the cans that had water or figure out what was involved. And you know, it's just cram it down on the poor carrier.
Well, let me ask you a question, Hank, as a segue. The shipment was delivered. It's signed off. What is a motor carrier's responsibility once he delivers the shipment, where does his responsibility end?
Well, here's the story, and it's involved with concealed damages. The fact that you sign for a delivery receipt, it's not shipper, load, and count, and you sign for it without noting any defect, creates a presumption that the carrier received it in good order. That presumption can be rebutted, but the burden of proof is on the carrier. Burden's on the proof to show that it was loaded hot out of the valley and that we didn't get a chance to pulp it, that kind of thing. Then on the consignee end, the same law approves that, you know, when you get a clear delivery receipt, that should be prima facie evidence that it was delivered in good order.
Right.
But when you drop a trailer into a pool and the guard signs for it, typically the shipper or consignee will insist that that's not constructive delivery and that it's not considered delivery until he gets his tow motor and unloads it and looks at it. And then the consignee will say, and oh, by the way, if we report a damage within 15 days, it will be considered as if it was reported when it happened. Now, all of that is mischief, you know. If he doesn't unload it and point out the damage while your driver is there, then the poor carrier, who may be domiciled 1,000 miles away, kind of has to take somebody's word for it. And
okay,
you don't know whether or not, oh, particularly with things like ice cream, you know, if the trailer's spotted, you don't know whether or not they opened the doors in the hot Memphis sun and waited 6 hours to unload the ice cream and then want to send you the bill.
Right,
because
or somebody.
That's one reason,
yeah, somebody
that,
fiddles with
you
the
know, unless you get to the point where more things are sealed loads and move like intermodal, as long as the seal's intact and the reefer's running, things are good. You know, it's really an I gotcha situation, and the driver has got to do far more than just physically get the truck from point A to point B, as this issue is pointing out.
So, all right. So my next question, this leads into my next question. So many of our listeners now are getting involved in some of these trailer pools for Amazon and even some for J.B. Hunt. I know they have their a program and a couple 360, and I think some of the other mega carriers do as well. What happens in the case where a motor carrier, one of our listeners, goes into a yard in Memphis, Tennessee, or into a yard or into a ship, or picks up a sealed trailer, drives it to Chicago, drops it off at a customer's in their yard, and then leaves, the seal's intact, and they open up the trailer when at the door, the shunt driver backs into a door, they bust open the seal, and one of two things, either, you know, it's full of water, or it's there's another issue, and the freight is all over the place. What happens then? Where's our carrier's liability? He didn't get to ever see what that freight looked like. It could have been, you know, again, it could have been somebody loaded a load of cans. They were sopping it, you know, they were sopping wet. They were rusting already when the darn things were loaded, delivers them from Memphis to Chicago, and they open them 2 days later in Chicago, and they've got, you know, a whole load of rusty cans at the other end. Where's the liability for our listener carriers?
Well, here in the States, there is what's called the Bill of Lading Act. It's a misnomer, but it says that if a shipment is shipper, load, and count, consignee, unload, and the bill of lading has those words on it, or words of similar import, that the carrier is not responsible for the piece count nor the condition of the load as a result of upset. Now, that basically means if you weren't there when it was loaded and you didn't examine it, then basically, if there's a seal intact at origin and a seal intact at destination, and they open up the doors and stuff all falls out, unless they can prove there was hard braking or some other act or omission of the carrier, it's presumed that it wasn't packed by the consignor to withstand the perils of transportation. And similarly, if there's a short count, and the bill of lading said there were 22 skids, and you get it open, there are only 21, but the seal's intact, then in both those cases, the carrier has probably got a pretty strong defense. I suggest that it's analogous to what happens in the intermodal world. I'm sure we got somebody on the line who is a dray carrier. You know, you pick up a box that's got a seal intact, and it came all the way from the Orient, and you
right.
you deliver it as a dray carrier 30 miles down the road. You damn well didn't have a chance to open it up and count it or certify what was in there. And if the seal's intact, you can legitimately say, hey, boss, it wasn't lost, stolen, or damaged on my tour. Now, particularly when we start talking about this power-only concept, which is what you're talking about with Amazon
right.
and J.B. Hunt 360, that is even better, I think, for a small carrier. And I think it's going to be a wave of the future because a small carrier, once we figure out how to be able to enter a trailer interchange in Memphis to pick up a load, drop that trailer in Chicago, and then go to another trailer pool and issue another trailer interchange and take another load somewhere, you're going to have a rather sweet spot for carriers because small carriers, because just think, it takes out the having to live load. It takes out all of the delay time. It takes out the idea that you were 30 minutes late, so now you didn't hit the window, so you forfeit your freight charges. All of the inefficiencies that the ELD had mandated, it kind of helps eliminate that. And for consignors who buy into the concept, you know, it's a whole lot easier to have three trailers out there in the pool than to be paying detention on trying to floor plan trucks. So I think that could really, really work. The devil's going to be in the detail, but I think that's particularly what Hunt's trying to do. And I think that there's so much pressure on the independent contractor model that you're, particularly in places like California, that you're going to see sophisticated larger carriers looking to fulfill more and more of their excess capacity by hiring licensed small carriers that are providing power only.
Yeah, I can
look
see
at it
that.
This
and...
way. The question of the leaky trailer goes away if the trailer belongs to the steamship line or belongs to Hunt.
Right. Now, what happens in a case, though, where, and I'm sure you've seen it in your law practice, where somebody does pick up this trailer and does damage it. I guess as long as they damage the front or the back where you can see it, I guess if somehow they damage the middle of it, catch the middle of a trailer on a bridge somehow, I've actually seen that happen down in the east, where they go in, drivers are going through a low bridge where there's a beam that's just in the center on one side of the bridge, and they just clip it. Where you end up, you don't notice the damage until you
yeah,
open
but,
the doors and unload.
You know, you look at it this way, Chuck. Trailer damage is just like cargo damage. There can be concealed trailer damage. But here's the way that a power-only move goes. I did a webinar on this, and I can probably give somebody the PowerPoint. But to make it work, there is a trailer interchange agreement incorporated into the contract and reflected as a receipt given at the time the trailer is picked up. The carrier is
right.
picking up not only the cargo for which it has cargo insurance, it's also picking up a trailer for which it has FISDAM insurance. And that's an addition on the carrier's policy. So in order to participate, I assume with Hunt 360 and Amazon, if they got enough sense to understand it, is that the carrier, as part of the program, has to provide a standard concurrence that says that it will accept liability for the trailer from the time of interchange to the time of delivery. It'll indemnify the party that owns the trailer against vicarious liability or violation of safety regulations, and that if the trailer is damaged in transit, they'll pay the claim. So ostensibly, if you're picking up a loaded trailer with a seal on it under this deal, you basically got to kick the tires and examine the trailer and convince yourself that you're willing to accept responsibility. So it's received in good condition, just like its cargo. And in
right.
theory, when you drop it into the pool and turn it back to Hunt or to Amazon, if Amazon doesn't go out and do a walk around on the trailer, then they're going to have hell trying to get your insurer to pay a claim. And so,
right,
you know, it's
you're
just
signing
a,
off on
a
it.
Question of doing the same kind of due diligence in terms of inspecting the condition of the trailer. A whole lot easier to inspect the trailer than it is to pulp the cabbage.
Right, exactly. And it's, you know, another thing I want to add to that, if you're pulling these trailers and they don't have, and most of them do not have disc brakes, I can't advise strongly enough, get under there and check the brakes, because there's a chance, you know, that something could be wrong with the braking system, and you don't want to get dinged at a scale and get put out of service because you've hooked up to a trailer. And some of these trailers, and I've heard stories from friends of mine and some of our listeners on the show that, you know, who work for large carriers where they're doing a drop trailer program. And some of these trailers from some very respectable transport companies are not in great shape. You know, some of them are downright out of service. And, you know, you're risking your life and other people's life and your livelihood when you pull up, you know, you hook up to these things if they're not safe. So, you know, you
yeah,
have to
I,
do
I
your...
I agree with you. You know, Chuck, I think that technology is making that a little bit better. For years, large carriers would have a 3-to-1 trailer to power ratio, and
right.
you know, sometimes they didn't have enough sense to figure out where a trailer was in their system for literally months. I've had lawsuits in which people have gone looking for trailers only to find out other people have been pulling them around the country. Now with trailer tracking and, you know, I understand that there are some more sophisticated brake technology than having to, on the newer stuff, than having to crawl under and slip, check the pull. I think maybe some of that is getting cleared out. Over on the
yep.
intermodal section, there has always been the distinction made in terms of who's required to maintain the chassis, and the chassis were maintained so poorly by the steamship lines that the carriers just balked, and they
right.
came out with a concept called roadability and tried to jam some of those inadequate trailers back against the trailer pool. So,
right.
I mean, there are real issues there. I've thought that if people like Convoy Go and these other folks that are trying to put together these trailer pools, and actually the idea of having the trailer released from a major pool where they can be inspected in and inspected out is a far better scheme than a lot of this, drop it in the back 40 and we'll go get it.
Right. I agree. And there's some, there's some accountability from the owners and some responsibility taken. You know, they're watching their stuff. And, you know, new trailers aren't cheap either.
No, and I mean, you know, you look at it this way, that traditionally a guy who's got one or two trucks is not only going to have to sleep in his truck, he's going to have to drag his trailer with him and live unload all his life, unless we get this trailer pool thing to work in a fashion in which a sustainable rate can be paid to the power only carrier and to the contracted carrier.
It's funny,
I think it's all about showing me the Benjamins, and I'm afraid that with the Amazon experience, there's no way to realize a profit at this point. I would hope that people like C.R. England and Hunt would have a more realistic approach towards what it takes a small carrier to survive.
Well, I know both those companies, and I think both of them do a great job. All of them do in their own way. I think that 360 program, from what I've seen of it, it's a darn good program in a lot of lanes. There's some lanes there's some bad lanes in the United States, let's face it, but there's some good lanes, and people can make money if they're, as long as they don't have, $5,700 a month truck payments, they can make money with this because they don't have the cost of, loading, unloading, or the cost of a trailer even. And again, trailers aren't cheap.
Well, yeah, I mean, as long as there are trailer pools, and, I think some of these people, Convoy and the rest of these folks, are trying to basically say, you come with us and we'll pre-plan your week for you. We'll send you from Memphis to Chicago. You drop in our marshalling yard. You pick up one from Chicago. We got your pre-plan to Denver. Since you don't have any downtime waiting to get to a freight dock, we can plan your whole week out, and you'll be home watching your kid play ball. I think it's really damn hard if you're stuck with the call boards and the last minute whore's market that the transactional thing can be. Not getting frustrated and losing time and productivity. So, I mean, in theory, it's a neat idea. The devil's just going to be in the detail.
And I think over time, I think we're just at the start of this whole new way of doing things, and which is an old way, because you and I are both old enough. I don't know if that's fortunately or unfortunately, but we're both old enough to remember when everybody interlined. And most of our listeners don't even know what we're talking about, but interlining is when a carriers used to swap trailers because you had a carrier that had authority in Illinois, but he couldn't cross the line into Missouri. And then the carrier would take it from the Missouri line to the Oklahoma line, but he wasn't allowed in Oklahoma, and another carrier would hook up to it, and he would take it, from Oklahoma all the way to the other side of the state, whether it was going to the south side, the north side, or the west side. And that's how it worked. And
let me interrupt you here. It's important to distinguish the term interline and interchange. In the old days,
right,
particularly when everybody was an LTL carrier, the freight was interline. So the
right
bill of lading might say PIE, but the delivering carrier was Hohenwald Express. And
right,
it was the freight that was cross-docked at Nashville to go to Hohenwald. That's an interline. But an interchange is when the tractor or the trailer moves in a through movement. And so what happens is the delivering carrier becomes responsible not only for the freight for the last miles, but is using typically the trailer. So you would see,
right,
if there was a truckload originating in Hohenwald, Tennessee, Hohenwald would go down and pick it up on a PIE trailer and
right
deliver it to PIE in Nashville to take to wherever. And so what you really got is you got two things. Is the trailer being convenience interlined, or is it being interchanged? Or is the freight being interlined? So they're two certainly related concepts. One applies to the movement of the freight by two carriers. The other provides for when one carrier uses the equipment of the other.
Okay. Well, no,
to
thank you for
movement. Yeah,
makes,
I mean,
yeah.
It's a little distinction, but you'll see in case law that and in the regs, people get confused about it. Interchange
right.
is a term that's in the leasing regulations. Interline is this old concept that, you know, when every carrier could get authority nationwide, kind of collapsed. You know, nobody
right.
needed to, had to go through Hohenwald truck lines to get access to Hohenwald.
Right. Yeah, that was, it's funny, you know, that I remember reading not too long ago that the first coast-to-coast, and I think it was LTL shipment, done by one carrier wasn't until 1960. And I think it was PIE, or it was either PIE or it was, it was CF, CF did it, and it went from California to New York or California to Boston. That was the first one, 1960. It's not that long ago.
One of the major line haul carriers, we get in Chicago, there was an outfit called Illinois California Express. And
right.
they were, in the old days, they were one of the few guys that was basically running pools. You know, if you could
right.
get it to ICX, you know, you had an interline partner that could get it across the river.
Right.
But, you know, there used to be, in the old days, there used to be motels that were run as interline interchange shops. And you pull into that motel and somebody would cut yourself a triplet. And that was because the truck had to be placarded with the name of the carrier who had the authority to go to Hohenwald. So
right.
if you want to take a truck to Hohenwald, you might stop at Memphis and slap a Hohenwald placard on the door so that the cops wouldn't stop you for going into Lewis County without appropriate authority.
That's funny.
Fortunately,
you know,
those days are gone, but they're still in the regs.
Yeah, those were good days, too. You know what? We ran a, I guess maybe I will say it on the air, we ran a gypsy outfit in those days, and what we did a little bit different. We would rent the truck or lease the truck directly to the customer and make it look like we were competing with Hertz and Ryder. There wasn't a Penske in those days. I don't even think he was racing cars. And that's what we did. And we got away with it for the most part, especially in the USA. We got away with it a little bit in Ontario, which is a long story because I had a long legal battle with the Ontario Ministry of Transport. And most of Canada, other than Quebec, didn't really recognize it, and you'd have to, you know, sneak around the scale at night or have a damn good story.
Well,
but in the U.S.,
we had it down here when authority was difficult to get, and a shipper had enough volume of freight to make it work. So basically, they didn't have the problem, entry problem, getting the authority. They just had to put their name on the door and take ultimate legal liability for the school bus they hit. And
right.
if they were willing to hire Snow Leasing to provide them be a fleet operator to them, providing equipment with driver, then you know it was on their scorecard.
Right. So we did the same thing up here as well. In some cases where there was a volume shipper, we would put their name on the door. We'd have an actual lease, a long-term lease in the truck. But the driver would have to work for a driver service agency, which is a labor pool. And that's how we circumvented the law. And it would drive the Ministry of Transport crazy. But they let us kind of do it in some cases. You know, it was.
Yeah, get you a leasing company and a rent a driver operation.
That's
and you're
exactly
ready
what
to rock. You know, Snow. Yep. I think we're probably reminiscing about things that most of our readers don't really care about. Maybe we better get back on topic.
I think so. We kind of went off track there. So the next thing we want to talk about really is We got a couple. We don't have enough time. We only have about 15 minutes, which really means 13 because I want to tell people how to get hold of us. So I think we should talk about some of these things we're seeing now with, and it happens all the time, and these deals, the never-never plan. How many have you seen work where a carrier sells a truck or leases a truck to a driver, and at the end of 24 or 36 months or 48 months, the driver walks away with a fairly new truck that he got into that is now paid for? How often do you see it work? How often do you see it fail?
Well, from my point of view, that is one of the hottest topics of litigation in what's called the misclassification suits. There are some carriers, some people that I represent that I think really have the right attitude towards it. They view the owner operator as a pearl of great price because they realize that getting and keeping a motivated driver who wants to have skin in the game and wants to succeed is viewed as a far better matchup on a percentage than it is to hire an employee who has a different cost structure and a different attitude. These people, the ones that sit down and play realistic, and it's usually not the new truck, it's the truck that's coming that they financed, and maybe it's got a four-year pay down. If they're ready to turn that truck, and they will tell a potential owner operator, look, man, I'm basically going to sign to you my rights and remedies against Peterbilt, and you just pay this thing on down to zero at what was my negotiated rate. Then that's not a never never plan, because
right.
When it's set up so that the owner operator, if he falls out of like with the carrier, can buy off the truck for the residual. He's got what they call skin in the game, and he's got portability. Now that's a win-win situation.
Right.
But I'll tell you, I was actually on the phone with a carrier before we started this, and they said, look, you know, you get these people, they come in. They want a nearly new truck, and you got one of two things to do. You can't, first of all, a carrier who leases to own is probably a fool in these days. But, you know, if you're going to help them finance it and you want to look at their project, they can't make any money and feed their family if their payments per week get so astronomical. And you know, if their credit is in the clinker, so that they're paying half again as much as a monthly payment than the carrier does, they're underwater. So how do you get their low monthly payments to the right level so that they really do have a chance to, at the end of the lease, get title of the truck and you know, it's like paying off your home mortgage. You know, it's a hallelujah goal. And I know exactly what you're talking about in terms of these never-never plans because, you know, a lot of people say, well, I've ridden this old truck now. It's the end of the lease, but the buyout is $15,000. The truck's worth $10,000. So,
right.
You know, that is really the issue. And all I can say is, The leasing companies that lease it to you, unless you've got you know, a good down payment and are well financed, you got to look at this like you would buying a house. Just don't assume that you're not going to pay for it on the back end if you've got an extremely low monthly payment. You know, I'd like to see a well written lease track to, you know, a nominal payment at the end. hoping that the owner operator is a good shade tree mechanic and takes good care of his equipment and has got something.
Right.
Also, I think it's really important that the lease not. I've seen these daggone leases that say, you know, if you stop working for Carrier X, you're going to buy the truck, or you're going to pay a prepayment penalty, which is just really a bad deal for the independent contractor.
And I've heard of ones that were so tough, you know, you make these payments, and if you leave the company, you leave the truck, even though you've got equity, because a lot of these people don't have the financial credibility to get financed anywhere else. That's where some of these companies
have them. Chuck, but you know, the flip side of that is the owner-operator should be able to leave the company. He should be able to go to the financier and say, look, I'm going to go from Carrier X to Carrier Y, but Carrier Y is going to agree to continue to withhold my payments and pay you. And the truck leasing company should say, hey, that's great. Or if at any time he wants to go ahead and pay the truck off, there should be a residual just like there is on a mortgage. If I had to say I want to pay off my home mortgage, you know, I know each month what the residual is. That's what's called
right.
Skin in the game. But something that says that, at least in my estimation, that says the lessor says you can only use this truck to haul for Carrier X. Listen, that's kind of I owe my soul to the company store, and you know I wouldn't be approving that.
And what about though when the carrier you're leased with is actually holding the paper, and that's the ones I've heard of where the carrier is actually holding the paper because the truck is paid for after 4 years. They sell you a 4-year-old truck, and they hold the paper. And if you leave, they won't let you take the truck. And I've heard of those deals, and they're awful deals, but people still get into them because they think they're going to beat the system. They remind me of those mechanical bulls that people try to ride in the bars out west, and the drunks keep getting thrown off, and there's always a new drunk to get on and try his skill at it.
Well, that's what you just mentioned is what in legal parlance. Increasingly, it's what's called a tying relationship. And by tying, they mean that your ability to lease and keep the truck is tied to you continuing to work for the carrier. And
right.
The courts are getting very, very quick to say that, look, what you're really doing is you're hiring this guy to drive your truck, and you're tying his arms and legs behind him, and once you get through deducting for the truck, you really need to answer for workman's comp, for unemployment insurance, for our federal FLSA.
Right.
You need to... we're going to reclassify that dude, and you need to pay him for a minimum net weekly pay if he's away from home for 116 hours times 750. So any week that dude didn't get, 116 hours times 750, good Lord, I can't do it in my head, but trust me, it's a bunch of money, and
right.
Most people know that if you're an independent contractor, you're going to have good weeks and you're going to have bad weeks. You're going to have weeks in which you took on a saddlebag full of fuel and you didn't get that amount. So, I mean, it just makes hash out of the whole independent contract.
Right.
You know, your settlement payments are going to come out the first week, so that week you're not going to make you know, necessarily $800 or whatever. It's making hash out of the independent contractor model, and the gateway towards from a carrier's point of view is to be abusive with those kinds of tying relations.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know,
but,
it's ruined,
you know,
a lot of.
Then after you get through with all of that, from the carrier point of view, or from absent to, you know, becoming a labor issue, the question is, if you're talking about a business to business relationship, and any other relationship where an independent contractor, independent businessman is, let's say, entering a franchise deal to buy a Hardee's, well, you know, you got to say, hey, am I going to make enough money to cover all of these the cost of furnishing the restaurant? Nobody promises a Hardee's franchisee that you know how many hamburgers they're going to sell. But the costs are fixed, and you have to make a business decision. So,
yeah.
You know, I think what we're getting very close on is something that RICO has really preached. And you know, the folks that come along and coach independent contractors preach, which is, you know, you're going to be your own businessman. That's ultimately the American dream. But don't go into it thinking that the government's here and they're going to protect you, because you know if you want an hourly wage job and are happy to work a 9-to-5, you don't need to be an owner operator.
No, and you know what? Talking to a lot of people that want to become owner operators, the major reason, now I don't know what your tax rules are down south of the border. But I know up here when I talk to these people, and I go, why do you want to buy a truck? And they go, so I don't have to pay income tax, so I can get my money and I can write things off. And I just shake my head and I go, that's a real dumb reason to go out and buy a truck, is to not pay income tax, because you probably won't pay any income tax because you're not going to make any money right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, down here, if you are a businessman, you can be more freewheeling, I guess, with what you write off.
Right.
An expense is an expense, and you can't take it home to mama. And I don't
right.
care whether or not you, I don't care whether or not you're an independent contractor or not. But you know, I'm on this thing speaking from my home where my office is. I don't fiddle with writing off the home. As an office, it's just too hard to do. But an owner
right.
operator who works out of his house is probably going to get, if he's shrewd, to take some of his home expenses off as a legitimate expense. He's also going to be able to get depreciation, which is a quick tax boost to encourage him to buy equipment, and depending upon how his deal is structured, you'll be able to expense those lease payments. And so there are tax benefits. Ultimately, down here, if you're a W-2 employee, there has to be withholding, and you have to pay your share of FICA, FUTA, and a whole bunch of other tests that may be viewed as a tax advantage.
Hank,
but,
we're going to have we're running short of time here, and I want our listeners to be able to, if they need to contact you, how can they get hold of you?
I think the easiest way is just to remember transportationlaw.net. Be sure you put .net after it. That's transportationlaw.net. That's our firm website. My contact information is there. There are a whole lot of fairly well-indexed articles on transportation questions. I've got a book called The Rules of the Road. You can get there, and it's pretty well-indexed and can can help you with a lot of the kind of strange questions that have been asked tonight. So remember, just transportationlawallwrittentogether.net.
Thank you. And you can get hold of me, 800-388-4352, extension 203, or you can email me, chuck@traffix.com, or you can catch me on Instagram, Chuck Snow, CEO, send me a private message. We are right out of time. I want to thank you, Hank. You have been fantastic. What a wonderful co-host. I've enjoyed every second talking to you. I've learned so much. Rico, we missed you tonight. Hope we catch up next week. I want to thank everybody out there that called in tonight and listened to the show, and those people are going to listen to it tomorrow online and the next day. I want everybody to be safe. Have a wonderful evening. Be profitable, and we'll catch you on the flip-flop. Good night.
Yeah, and Rico's thing about keeping between the mustard and the mayonnaise, I don't know it. That too.
Well said. Keep it between the mustard and the mayonnaise, as Rico says. Good night and God bless.
Good night. Bye-bye.